somewhere I read, of the freedom of speech.
Et qui défendait la liberté d'expression.
The moment you limit free speech, it's not free speech.
Somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people.
Welcome to Clear and Present Danger, a history of free speech, by Jakub Mshangama.
Clear and Present Danger relies on the generous support of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, Fridor, and the Politiken Foundation.
Episode 5, The Caliphate. On 14 February 1989, the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khomeini, issued a fatwa sentencing British author Salman Rushdie to death. He had blasphemed against Islam and the Prophet Muhammad in his novel The Satanic Verses. And according to Khomeini, it was now the duty of all Muslims to execute the fatwa, forcing Rushdie into hiding. The Rushdie affair ignited a conflict that continues to flare up with the Danish cartoons and the attack on French magazine Charlie Hebdo as the most prominent examples. For many in the West, these events have led to the question, and for some perhaps a firm conclusion, of whether Islam is inherently opposed to ideas that contradict its principles. But such a view ignores at least two important points. The victims of blasphemy and apostasy laws are predominantly Muslims and religious minorities in Muslim-majority countries, not in the West. Secular bloggers jailed in Saudi Arabia, unorthodox Shia clerics imprisoned in Iran, Ahmadiyya Muslims targeted in Pakistan, and so on. In fact, the highest number of casualties of the Rushdie affair took place in Turkey, when in 1993 extremists torched a hotel where the Turkish translator of the Satanic Verses participated in a conference of mostly Alevite Muslims. 37 were killed. And 4 years before the Rushdie affair, Sudanese religious scholar Mahmoud Muhammad Taha was executed for apostasy after advocating a tolerant version of Islam. Egyptian secularist Farrakh Fawda suffered the same fate when assassinated by Islamist militants in 1992. In other words, the burning question of how much free speech is permissible in Islam is not merely or chiefly a conflict between Islam and the West. It's a conflict between competing conceptions of permissible thought among Muslims themselves. And it's not a new one. The competing conceptions of what constitutes permissible inquiry and what constitutes heresy or apostasy has historically given rise to important discussions and clashes during medieval Islam, the period covered in this episode. True, the strict monotheism and insistence on the eternal truth of the Quran as revealed through prophecy sets important limits on speech and ideas. Medieval Islam had its inquisitions and persecutions of both heretical Muslims and non-Muslim minorities. Nothing like the Athenian concepts of isogoria and paresia became part of the political culture of the dominant caliphates. And needless to say, at this point of our journey, we're still in a galaxy far, far away from modern concepts of free speech. But even if free speech was not positively defined or even acknowledged, the shifting degrees of tolerance negatively defined the limits of speech and thought in practice. And from the middle of the 8th century, classical Greek science and philosophy found extremely fertile ground in the vast empire of the Abbasid Caliphate. Almost all secular Greek works of science and philosophy were translated into Arabic. This would give rise to a number of prolific Muslim polymaths and philosophers who improved upon the Greek ideas that had got them thinking in the first place. It would even see brilliant free thinkers who rejected the relevance of revealed religion altogether. the translations and comments on Greek works also contributed to the retransmission of classical works in the Latin West, in particular Aristotle, as well as a renaissance in the Byzantine East, where for two centuries interest in secular works had almost died out amid strict orthodoxy and iconoclasm. The medieval controversies over where to draw the line between free thought and apostasy or heresy, it's also crucial to understanding why this question still gives rise to violent conflicts in the 21st century. For all these reasons, medieval Islam plays an important indirect role in the history of what would later be defined as free speech. Before I delve into the general story, I need to make a few initial remarks. Born and raised in Western Europe, I am much more familiar with what we might call the Western tradition than with the history of the Islamic world. People in the West generally have a rudimentary knowledge of formative periods such as antiquity, the Middle Ages, and so on. That familiarity is sadly lacking when it comes to the Islamic world, where the names, vocabulary, and events do not resonate with the same received wisdom. In other words, there's an even higher risk than usual that my historical context and descriptions sometimes miss the mark. But if this episode inspires some of you to do your own digging around, then perhaps I might be forgiven for any mistakes in the following. The Prophet Muhammad died in 632 AD. Upon his death, the new faith of Islam would spread out from the Arabian Peninsula and conquer all before it at breakneck speed. About a century later, Islam was a state religion in the now extinct Sasanian Persian Empire, as well as huge parts of what had belonged to the Byzantine Empire. But despite the incredible success, all was not well. There had been serious schisms, or fitnas, along the way, owing to fundamental disagreements on who should be the successor to the Prophet. Schisms that brought sectarianism and division within the house of Islam, at a time when what Islam actually meant was still being debated. Some of these divisions would never be healed and grew permanent, such as the split between Sunni and Shia Islam. In 661, the Umayyads won a Muslim civil war and established the Umayyad dynasty, whose capital was in Damascus in modern-day Syria. Orthodoxy was not authoritatively defined along the lines of a, say, Nicene Creed or by an official religious institution as we knew it from Christianity. So the red lines would change depending on the specific theological inclination of the caliph, based not least on which ideas might threaten his position. And around 684, the Umayyad caliph Abd al-Malik would establish the first attempt to suppress heretics. What particularly worried Abd al-Malik and his later son Hisham Abd al-Malik was apparently religious scholars emphasizing the concept of free will. That doctrine undermined the idea of predestination central to the legitimacy of the Umayyads. Among the victims was an ascetic whose dreams were a little too vivid for his own good. He saw visions of Satan, and instead of blaming it on too much spicy food, he concluded that he was a prophet. There may not yet have been agreement on all central doctrines of Islam at this point, but prophecy was not to be messed with. Muhammad was, after all, the seal of prophets, and so around 699, the dreamer was crucified. In 724, Hisham Abd al-Malik got the top job. He made an unmistakable example out of a religious scholar who apparently denied the truthfulness of the interaction between God and Moses. But instead of crucifying him, like other heretics, he was saved for a special occasion, the feast of ritual sacrifice where lambs are slaughtered. In front of a huge crowd, the scholar was bled to death in an allusion to God's command that Abraham sacrifice Isaac, only to have an angel interfere at the last moment. We don't know whether the victim cried out to God for help, but if so, his executors might well have retorted, "Oh, what's that? Oh, now you believe God can talk to humans. The Umayyad persecution of heretics may well have paved the way for a more famous Islamic Inquisition that took place once the Umayyads were swept from power by the Abbasids in 750. The Umayyads had based their rule on Arab kinship, discriminating against the many non-Arab Muslims under their rule. The Abbasids built their claim to power on a more egalitarian and inclusive model, where Islam, not ethnicity, was decisive. This secured the support of local Muslims from the province of Khorasan, comprising northeastern Iran and most of Central Asia. As we shall see, the Khorasan province would play an important role in the intellectual life of the Abbasid Caliphate. Accordingly, non-Arab Muslims, not least the many Persians, could claim a stake for themselves and climb the ladder of socio-economic prestige. And while this inclusive model cultivated support from broader constituencies of the Ummah, the Fellowship of Believers, it also increased the danger of inviting fifth columns of insincere Muslims into the caliphate's bureaucracy. This created a certain paranoia, fueling the first Abbasid Mina, or Inquisition, aimed at the Zandaka. Zandaka was originally a Persian term for Manichaeans, the followers of a dualist religion founded by its prophet Mani around 240 AD. You might remember that Manichaeans were persecuted by both the pagan emperor Diocletian and Christian emperors like Theodosius. And in 780, the mantle was picked up by Abbasid Caliph al-Mahdi. His target was mainly Persian Muslims who had converted from Manichaeism, but were thought to be fair-weather Muslims, and whose hidden loyalty was a threat to the religious and political order of the caliphate. Though some argue that political reasons weighed heavier than religious ones. 4.5 centuries before the first papal inquisition in 1231, al-Mahdi appointed a master of heretics to supervise the Zandaka trials. Suspects were interrogated. If found guilty, they were given the chance to repent or risk execution. The number of persons interrogated is unknown, but it came to affect both Arabs and Persians, including writers, poets, and civil servants. The persecution was formally terminated by Caliph Harun al-Rashid in the 780s. But as happens so often with inquisitions, mission creep set in, and Zandaka came to denote a more general form of heresy, which could include showing a lack of respect towards the Sharia, the Islamic law, or too daring forms of free thinking that would affect writers, poets, and others during Abbasid times. But the Zandaka Inquisition was not a general attempt to develop and enforce a rigorous orthodox version of Islam, which at this time was still in flux. According to traditional Muslim historiography, it was only in 644 that the compilation of an authoritative Quran had been initiated. And from the 8th to the 10th centuries, there was a lively theological debate between different schools of Islam. These schools competed among themselves as to who could offer the most persuasive and authoritative interpretation of the Quran and Sunnah, the sources of Sharia law. This was also the time when the four major Sunni schools of Islamic law, Hanafi, Shafi, Hanbali, and Maliki, would develop. Key to these schools was the interpretation of hadiths, authoritative accounts of the Prophet's example, which would also be collected and edited in this period. The different theological schools did not have the power to enforce their version of orthodoxy, so the frequent insults and accusations of heresy or improper innovation they hurled at each other did not translate into persecution, unless the caliph sided with one school or the other. That's exactly what happened in 833, when Caliph al-Ma'mun forbade opposition to his preferred doctrine that the Quran was created rather than the uncreated word of God. The former was a central tenet of the Mu'tazilite school of thought that had a more rationalistic and allegorical approach to Islam and included an emphasis on free will. The opposite view was championed by what we may call traditionalists among the ulama, specialist scholars of religious law. So ironically, Mamun would claim as the only permissible truth doctrines that had been a red line for the Umayyads. A perfect example of the red line shifting according to political expediency. Elevating the Quran to the uncreated word of God would strengthen the role of the ulama, while a more rationalistic approach would leave room for religious arguments outside the Quran and Sunnah. This meant more wiggle room for the caliph, including his emphasis on pagan Greek learning and falsafa, the Islamic term for philosophy, as we'll explore shortly. Al-Ma'mun first presided over the interrogation of judges and witnesses who were forced to swear allegiance to the new doctrine. Then he ordered the inquisition of new waves of suspects, including jurists and theologians. Dissenters were forced to publicly recant or risk imprisonment, flogging, or even execution. Of far-ranging consequence was the trial of Ibn Hanbal, a prodigious traditionalist jurist, hadith scholar, and later founder of the strict Hanbali school of Islamic law. Hanbal was arrested and tried, but refused to recant. Hanbal languished 2 years in prison in Baghdad before he was tried and let off with a whipping. Hanbal became a martyr for the traditionalist among the ulama, who united in their resistance against the createdness doctrine. These scripturalists became known by their theological opponents as Hashwiya, a mocking term meaning those who uselessly fill their speeches with quotations from the Quran and the Sunnah. But the Hashwiya would have the last laugh. And in 848, Caliph al-Mutawakkil not only ended the Mina, but endorsed the uncreatedness doctrine of the traditionalists. He even turned the tables again and imprisoned persons who were too rationalistic. This marked a watershed moment in the relationship between the caliph and the ulama. The Mina was an attempt to ensure the caliph's central role in determining religious orthodoxy and limit the religious influence of the ulama. Instead, the ulama had ultimately won caliphal support for one of their central doctrines, emphasizing a more scriptural approach of which they were the experts. Down the road, this would have serious consequences for the permissible limits of interpretation, inquiry, and religious tolerance, and not least the question of apostasy and blasphemy that is still with us today. The Quran is clear in its condemnation of apostasy, but it does not explicitly stipulate worldly punishments. But the Sunnah includes a number of instances where Muhammad lays down the law with brutal severity. In a famous hadith, Muhammad says, "Anyone who changes his religion, kill him." According to the prominent contemporary scholar of Islamic law, Muhammad Hashim Kamali, there is strong evidence that the Prophet ordered or approved the death penalty in around a dozen cases involving blasphemy or apostasy. In one account, the Prophet ordered 2 slave girls executed for attacking him in poetical songs, which seems to have been a particularly sensitive issue for the Prophet and his followers. Kamali argues that in many of these cases, blasphemy or apostasy were combined with other crimes or general vilification of Islam and carried out amidst what today we'd call a national security crisis when the Muslim community was at war and allies left the fold of believers. Hence, these draconian punishments should be seen as responding to high treason as much as for religious transgression. We recognize that idea from the Theodosian Code that expanded treason laws to cover religious crimes. But killing girls for singing seems quite a stretch to justify under any circumstances. The reliability of these sayings are probably impossible to resolve, and some argue they were invented to suit the agenda of later rulers who needed prophetic blessings for their repression of dissent. Whether in accordance or contravention of the Prophet's example, all the 4 dominant Sunni schools of Islamic law agree that apostasy is punishable by death. And to complicate the issue further, blasphemy is often seen as constituting automatic apostasy, without any clear definition of this crime. A 13th century compendium of Hanbali jurisprudence includes the following expressions as apostasy.
Vilifying Allah the Exalted or his Prophet, falsely impugning the honor of the Prophet's mother, denying the book of Allah or a part of it, denying one of his prophets or one of his books, rejecting a manifest and agreed upon commandment, such as the five pillars of Islam, or making licit a well-known and agreed upon prohibition, such as wine, pork, illicit intercourse, and the like.
With such a broad definition of apostasy, one might have expected chopped off heads flying left and right. But the Ashafi and Hanafi schools that dominated the eastern part of the caliphate required apostasy to be openly declared and that apostates be given the chance to repent to escape execution. This meant that punishments for apostasy were rare. And apart from the minas, heterodoxy was largely left alone by the authorities, even though condemnations and warnings of hellfire were frequent. But this would change in the 11th century through the influence of the stricter Hanbali school, and not least the writings of the hugely influential theologian and lawyer Al-Ghazali. More on that later. Obviously, apostatizing from Islam is only possible for Muslims, but sab, or what we would call blasphemy, was also punishable if committed by dhimmis, non-Muslims otherwise protected by the Islamic State. So if you were a Christian longing for martyrdom, publicly vilifying the Prophet was just the ticket. We'll go more into the limits of tolerance and religious freedom for non-Muslims in two episodes' time when we deal with the establishment of Inquisitions in the Christian West and compare the levels of tolerance in medieval Christendom and Islam. Okay, so we've seen the perhaps not so surprising fact that religious autocrats crack down on political and religious dissent. But despite the minas and occasional persecutions of heretics, the Abbasid Caliphate contributed vastly to expanding the limits of medieval thought and reason. In fact, without the Abbasids, the rediscovery of classical knowledge that would take place in the West after the turn of the millennium might have been delayed and impaired. Even the Greek Byzantines, who had given up secular Greek writings for a couple of centuries, went back to study their pagan roots when their deadly rivals started churning out translations of Greek works. For though there were limits on dissent, knowledge and science would be prized by a succession of Abbasid caliphs, as well as some of the rulers who acknowledged the caliph's power only in name when the Abbasid caliphate became more of a loose commonwealth. A 13th century source claimed that Caliph Omar destroyed the Great Library of Alexandria when conquering the city in 642. Omar supposedly ordered all the books burned since they would either contradict or agree with the Quran and thus were either heretical or superfluous. But this is a myth. In fact, the eventual Abbasid successors of Caliph Omar would make the translation and ideas of Greek secular books part of the very ideology of their rule. And thereby, they contributed to saving, restoring, spreading, and improving upon the classical heritage. Al-Mansur was the second Abbasid caliph and ruled from 754 to 775. But in many ways, he was the founding father of the Abbasid caliphate. It was he who built Baghdad as the new capital in the early 760s. He was also the founding patron of the so-called Greco-Arabic translation movement, commencing in the middle of the 8th century. According to Yale professor Dimitri Gutas, by the end of the 10th century, almost all scientific and philosophical secular Greek works that were available in late antiquity, including such diverse topics as astrology, alchemy, physics, mathematics, medicine, and philosophy had been translated. This included works of Greek luminaries such as Galen, Euclid, Ptolemy, Plato, and Aristotle. The multi-ethnic and multi-religious character of the empire was of key significance to the culture sustaining the translation movement. In the Khorasan region, different cultures and religions had lived together in relative peace and created a culture of curiosity and open-mindedness prior to the Arab conquest. And by conquering former Byzantine lands, the Arabs had also gained control over massive holdings of Greek literature. Helping the translation movement was new paper technology arriving from China. And even more importantly, Arabic became the new lingua franca, which helped spread the new ideas and knowledge far and wide. Without the active participation of religious minorities, the translation movement could not have taken place. Nestorian Christians played a key role in translating Greek writings from Syriac into Arabic. Zoroastrian Persians were also instrumental in translating Greek works that had already been translated into Persian. And they also translated into Arabic Indian works on astronomy and mathematics from Sanskrit. It was a conscious top-down decision on part of Caliph Mansur and his successors to initiate a translation of secular Greek works. But it would enjoy broad support and patronage from within the elite of Abbasid society. Initially, the caliphs were mostly interested in astrology, which was seen as a science. And with the right interpretation, it could be used to demonstrate that God himself had determined that the Abbasids were the rightful commanders of the faithful. The Abbasids were also interested in applied and useful science. And soon, translations of philosophy needed to argue and defend specific government or religious policies would follow, not least based on Aristotle. The translations also served an ideological role in promoting Islam at the expense of its Christian rivals in the East and West. An 11th century Muslim scholar wrote that the Muslim Arabs had been without science except for religion and some medicine. But then, lo and behold, the Abbasids came along, though this source highlights the role of Al-Ma'mun, not his predecessor Al-Mansur.
Al-Ma'mun revived the teaching of medicine by favoring the most excellent of men. But for that, all the sciences of the ancients, including medicine, logic, and philosophy, would have been forgotten, just as they are forgotten today in the lands in which they were most specifically cultivated. I mean Rome, Athens, the Byzantine provinces, and in many other lands.
In other words, Al-Ma'mun sought to position Islam as the natural heir of Hellenistic thought, which the Christians had rejected for their misguided and false beliefs. According to this propaganda, Islam was enlightened and sophisticated, while Christianity was backwards and barbaric. The PR efforts would even include stories of how Al-Ma'mun talked to Aristotle in his dreams. Ma'mun goes on to ask Aristotle, "What is the best speech?" Aristotle responds, "Whatever is correct to personal judgment." So the head honcho of Islam not only legitimizes the pagan master of Greek thought. Aristotle's answer also conforms with Ma'mun's endorsement of Mu'tazilite rationalist theology. Not all dreams were dangerous in the caliphate. So highly was science valued in the 10th century that a professional translator could make up to 500 dinars a month. A dinar was made of 4.25 grams of close to pure gold. So 500 dinars would equal 2,125 grams or almost 75 ounces of gold. Per my quick Google search, the spot price for a gram of gold as I'm speaking is $42.55. So a translator could make more than the equivalent of $90,000 a month. Not bad if you were a Hellenophile bookworm. And when the translation movement ended its activities around the 10th century, it was not because of censorship or backlash, but because they ran out of relevant books to translate. But sometimes the translation movement has been given too romantic a light, especially when it comes to the so-called House of Wisdom or Bayt al-Hikmah. It is sometimes portrayed as the Islamic equivalent of the Great Library in Alexandria. But very few sources actually mention the House of Wisdom. It seems that in reality, it was a continuation of a Persian government institution housing a library and research function, and that under the Abbasids, it focused on translations from Persian to Arabic. So no, the House of Wisdom would not have been a research lab where Greek books were stored, translated, and researched. There were also works that didn't make the cut. The Arabs didn't translate the histories of Herodotus and Thucydides. This is pure speculation on my part, but works that include detailed discussions of democracy and the value of isagoria might give people wrong ideas about how political power should be distributed between the ruler and the ruled. It's hard to imagine the caliphs finding much to agree with in Pericles' funeral oration. Herodotus' unflattering portraits of the tyrannical and imperialist Persian kings beaten by the freedom-loving Greek underdogs might both have offended Persians and have provided dissidents with veiled anti-caliphal propaganda. Okay, so the Abbasids translated a lot of Greek works of science and philosophy. But anyone can imitate. What did the Arabs contribute themselves? Quite a bit, in fact. The list of outrageously gifted polymaths mastering disciplines such as medicine, astronomy, geography, and philosophy is long. Although, while most of these thinkers were Muslims, many were ethnically Persians or Central Asians writing in Arabic. It's also true that with time, Baghdad lost its central role and centers of learning spread east to territories where the Abbasid caliphs ruled in name only, if at all. In a free speech podcast, we have to focus on the most radical free thinkers, even though they constituted a tiny minority of Islamic thinkers and were often loathed as heretical. Take Abau ibn al-Rawandi and Muhammad ibn Zakariya al-Razi. Al-Rawandi is a bit of an enigma. Born around 827 in modern Afghanistan, he is said to have written more than 100 books, but none survive except as cited in the furious refutation by his many bitter critics. Al-Rawandi took an intellectual axe and mercilessly hacked away at the very roots of Islam. The Quran, an absurd book full of inconsistencies and not even particularly well-written or persuasive. Prophets? At best unnecessary. Humans can advance by their own intellect and don't need revelation. At worst, cheap frauds. Oh, and this included Muhammad. Miracles? Nothing but simple tricks and conspiracies to fool the gullible. The Muslim pilgrimage of the Hajj? An exercise in futility. Oh, and that goes for prayers too. All in all, religious dogma are portrayed as irreconcilable with reason. Had he lived in our time, Rawandi might have described revealed religion and their holy books as fake news. Rawandi seems a bit like a medieval Tom Paine, taking delight in the shock and outrage that followed in the wake of his one-man demolition show of revealed religion. Though, of course, Rawandi could plead innocence. You see, these brutal attacks on the core tenet of Islam were not always his own words. Oh no, no. They were merely a summary of how the Indian Brahmins looked at Islam. So why all the fuss? In another work, criticism of religion and prophecy took the shape of a debate between Al-Rawandi and his friend and mentor, with Rawandi defending prophecy and his mentor being the skeptic. But despite these thinly veiled attempts to dodge criticism, Rawandi became a favored target of the medieval equivalent of the Twitter mob, and he was viciously attacked by both religious scholars and rationalist philosophers. Another controversial figure was Razi, who died in 925. He was a prolific Persian physician and philosopher whose comprehensive work on medicine was translated into Latin as late as 1279. For Razi, reason was the ultimate authority which should govern and not be governed, should control and not be controlled, should lead and not be led. While the traditional view is that Razi was a radical freethinker critical of religion, some scholars think Razi may have criticized specific sects and doctrines rather than religion as such. In the following, I will present Razi the radical freethinker, but in an upcoming expert opinion, the other side will be given its due. Razi had a mind-boggling intellectual output. He wrote some 200 books on medicine, chemistry, alchemy, logic, and philosophy, and groundbreaking contributions to medicine. He's even said to have gone blind and become paralyzed in his hand from all the reading and writing. Once, he completed 20,000 pages in a single year. Razi, the freethinker, had an unorthodox take on religion, to say the least.
If the people of a given religion are asked about the proof for the soundness of their religion, they flare up, get angry, and spill the blood of whoever confronts them with this question. They forbid rational speculation and strive to kill their adversaries. This is why truth became thoroughly silenced and concealed.
He didn't think much of the Quran either.
You claim that the evidentiary miracle is present and available, namely the Quran. You say, whoever denies it, let him produce a similar one. By God, what you say astonishes us. You're talking about a work which recounts ancient myths and which at the same time is full of contradictions and does not contain any useful information or explanation. Then you say, produce something like it?
But Razi also explicitly defends what to modern ears sounds almost like a fundamental right for humans to think for themselves, regardless of authority, religious or secular. Despite his huge respect for Galen, the ancient Greek master of medicine, Razi found it necessary to criticize his source of inspiration.
The arts of medicine and philosophy will not support subordination to leaders and automatic acceptance of what they say, nor treating them leniently and refraining them from thorough examination of their claims.
For those who insisted that the authority of masters like Galen be accepted unquestioningly, Razi had a blunt reply.
I do not count him as a philosopher, for he has cast the philosopher's way behind his back, and has adopted the multitude's way of conforming with the leaders and refraining from criticism of them. The philosopher's way has always consisted of veneration of the leaders together with relentless critical examination with no leniency.
Razi's razor cut right through decaying ideas as well as tissue. How did these freethinkers escape persecution? Well, the fact that their controversial works have not survived hints that they probably didn't escape censorship. Rawandi may also have escaped being arrested and gone into hiding. And of course, if Razi was less iconoclastic than portrayed by his most hostile critics, then that may explain why he was left alone. As mentioned, Al-Rawandi and Razi were not mainstream thinkers of their day. And according to scholar of Islamic thought Sara Strumsa, their radical free thinking was even unique to Islam among the monotheistic faiths of the time. So it would be wrong to think that the many other great Muslim polymaths of the era were atheists who saw an irreconcilable barrier between reason and religion. In fact, several of them went out of their way to demonstrate just how Islam and reason went hand in hand, much like Aquinas would bridge reason and Christianity. We don't have the time to explore all these polymaths and their scientific and philosophical achievements, which is a convenient way for me to avoid exposing my superficial knowledge of these great thinkers. But we must give a brief mention of some of the giants, like the philosopher of the Arabs, Al-Kindi. Kindi expressed an open-mindedness that comes tantalizingly close to recognizing free speech.
We ought not to be ashamed of appreciating the truth and of acquiring it wherever it comes from, even if it comes from races distant and nations different from us. For the seeker of truth, nothing takes precedence over the truth, and there is no disparagement of the truth, nor belittling either of him who speaks it or of him who conveys it. The status of no one is diminished by the truth, rather does the truth ennoble all.
Al-Farabi was known as the second master. Only Aristotle ranked above him. Farabi actually discussed democracy and found that it possessed certain merits. Not to mention Biruni, who excelled in fields as diverse as astronomy, mathematics, history, and geography. But perhaps no one towers above Ibn Sina, also known as Avicenna. He not only became the most influential philosopher of his time, but, close your ears, disciples of Aquinas, perhaps also of the entire medieval period, shaping philosophy in Islamic, Christian, and Jewish thought. He also wrote the Canon of Medicine, translated into Latin, and for centuries one of the most influential medical works in Europe. Oh, and Ibn Sina also used his reasoning to demonstrate God's necessary existence, though the jury may still be out on that. If you want a more convincing introduction to Islamic thought than my hatchet job, I highly recommend Peter Adamson's excellent podcast, The History of Philosophy Without Any Gaps, which covers this territory in depth. And it just so happens that Peter Adamson will soon be joining us for an expert opinion on free thinkers in medieval Islam and Christendom, where, among other things, he will do his best to ruin Razi's bad boy reputation as a radical free thinker. But not everyone was a fan of the kind of free thinking that allowed Razi, Farabi, and Avicenna to thrive. Although the caliph's power had been clipped, the early part of the 11th century saw Caliph Al-Qadir seek to establish an orthodox Sunni creed inspired by the Hanbali school, which ironically was founded by the former prisoner of conscience, Ibn Hanbal. Heretics were purged, and heavy-handed censorship of rationalists and their writings introduced. Specifically, the caliph declared that anyone who advanced the createdness doctrine of the Quran was an apostate who could be killed. More intolerant winds also blew outside Baghdad, to the east in the Ghaznavid Empire, ruled by Mahmud of Ghazni, who nominally acknowledged the caliph in Baghdad. Mahmud took to crucifying, imprisoning, and exiling those whom the caliph had designated as being beyond the pale. Of key importance in establishing the new red lines was the hugely influential philosopher and theologian Al-Ghazali. His work, The Incoherence of the Philosophers, blasted Aristotelian philosophers like Avicenna and Farabi. Al-Ghazali is often depicted as strictly opposed to reason and philosophy as such. But modern scholars have pushed back hard against what they see as a misrepresentation of Ghazali's thought, arguing that he even created a doctrine of limited tolerance. What is not disputed is that Ghazali spelled out three specific propositions which amounted to apostasy. First, that the world is not created. Second, that God is not omniscient. And three, that the rewards and punishment in the next life are only spiritual in character. He would later add manifest rejections of monotheism to the list. So dangerous were these ideas that philosophers and theologians who advocated them should be killed with no chance to repent. In other words, Ghazali, also a judge, expanded the scope of apostasy laws to heterodox ideas among self-proclaimed Muslims who believed differently than Ghazali's idea of orthodoxy. Ghazali may have reserved the death penalty for very specific instances of apostasy and left the rest up to God. But the development towards hardening and widening apostasy laws went ahead with long-term consequences for tolerance and freedom of thought. Free thinking that outright rejected prophecy and grounded knowledge and truth in human reason instead of revealed religion seems to have withered away. The more restrictive approach also helps explain why there were occasional executions of apostates in some Muslim countries as late as the 19th and even the 20th century, as we saw with Mahmoud Muhammad Taha in Sudan. It also explains why some Sunni scholars and organizations agreed with Khomeini's fatwa that Rushdie, having been born a Muslim, could be killed as an apostate without a trial or the opportunity to repent for having vilified the Prophet. Farrakh Fawda, who like al-Rawandi used irony and sarcasm in his rejection of religious dogmatism, was killed by jihadists in 1992. It followed a fatwa by religious scholars at the Al-Azhar Islamic University, branding him a blasphemer. In an ironic twist, the influential Egyptian religious scholar named, you guessed it, Muhammad al-Ghazali, would in the spirit of his medieval namesake defend the assassination of Fawda, arguing that others had to do the dirty work when the state refused. And even today, 13 Muslim-majority countries formally punish apostasy or blasphemy with the death penalty, though executions are very rare. Despite the changing atmosphere of the 11th century, Muslim philosophers would continue to write and engage with the classical Greek heritage. Not least in the Umayyad holdover of Muslim Spain, or Al-Andalus, where in the 12th century, Averroes would have a major impact on Western philosophy. Averroes would launch his own attack on Ghazali, ingeniously called the Incoherence of Incoherence. More on Al-Andalus in 2 episodes' time. While a shadow of its former self, the Abbasid Caliphate would limp on until 1258, when the Mongols destroyed Baghdad, including its many libraries with their precious books. It was said that so many books were thrown into the Tigris River that the water turned black from all the ink that was washed away, along with untold treasures of knowledge, science, and philosophy. Next episode, we're back in Europe, where we'll explore the not-so-dark ages that the Arab translation movement and its learned offspring of philosophers and scientists helped illuminate. We'll meet brilliant medieval scholars at the new universities, where rediscovered knowledge and ideas would be taught and discussed when the students weren't too busy drinking and fighting. We'll also meet the censors who tried to stem the tide when the new ideas became too radical. That's in episode 6 of Clear and Present Danger, A History of Free Speech. Thank you very much for listening. Today's episode was edited by Søren Stehøj. If you like what you heard, please share the episode on social media and give us a review on iTunes. If you didn't like what you heard, let us know in the comments.